In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. One of the major criticisms of the climate change movement is the focus on ending CO2 emission while not putting more or at least equal effort into highlighting the research into infinite energy or zero-point energy. Where is any official demand by this movement to publicly release warehoused zero-point energy devices? Would they consider using their resources to protect and promote scientists or others willing to build zero-point energy devices from the ground up? We hear an interview from Russ Gerst about the work of Dr. Eugene Maloff and his 1989 book Fire from Ice that reports on tabletop cold fusion from Stanley Pons and Martin Fleshman at the University of Utah. Dr. Maloff was an American scientist, science writer, editor and publisher of Infinite Energy magazine, and founder of the nonprofit organization New Energy Foundation. He was a proponent of cold fusion and a supporter of its research and related exploratory alternative energy topics. Our guest, Russ Gerst, is a mathematics major and a CPA. He's worked with Dr. Judy Wood to help publish her book. He's researched the effort to cover up the science of free energy and some of the players that are involved up until today within the 9/11 truth movement. Let's have a listen. Dr. Judy Wood's groundbreaking book, titled Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy on 9/11, gathers amazing evidence revealing how the Twin Towers turned to dust in the air using energy waves directed in a way that they would interfere in particular zones. The subtitle of Dr. Wood's book, Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11, is an invitation to the reader to find out more about free energy, especially the type used during 9/11. Many researchers say this directed free energy technology is now weaponized and in the wrong hands. Further research into this realm is often eclipsed by the discussion of the towers collapsing or disintegrating. Dr. Wood has given the reader plenty of evidence revealing the free energy signature left at ground zero. Dr. Wood references the science of cold fusion, or more accurately termed transmutation, from the artifact remains from the destruction of the towers, such as bent beams, slow bending of metals, and melting without heat. She also references looking at the cold fusion story and suggests the book Fire from Ice, Searching for the Truth in the Cold Fusion Führer by Dr. Eugene Maloff. We talk today with Russ Gerst. He's a CPA, and he's also worked with Dr. Wood to help publish her book. He's knowledgeable about the effort to cover up the science of free energy and some of the players that are involved up until today within the 9/11 truth movement. But we're also going to get a behind-the-scenes look at the nature of cover-up and an insight into Dr. Wood's timeline of investigation. Russ, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
Excellent. We should start by reminding listeners, what is cold fusion? Dr. Woods more accurately says it's transmutation. But can you tell listeners a little bit about that?
Well, what Pons and Fleischmann kind of discussed or discovered back in 1989, and actually they had discovered it back in about 1984 or thereabouts, but what they found was that though it was like a nuclear reaction, it wasn't typical to like your hydrogen bomb or in particular more your fission bombs where you've got high volumes of radiation like your gamma rays and such. And what you do have more of is energy output, but you do have small signatures such as tritium production just in trace amounts, but definitely above background, what occurs in nature. So you do have that, and what they also found was that there is creation of other elemental forms that is coming maybe from the metal lattice, because what they found in their cold fusion, they were actually using anode and cathode of platinum and palladium. And the palladium, when you run an electric current through the water, it actually superpacks this deuterium, which is a heavy form of hydrogen, into the metal lattice. And inside that metal lattice, you're getting transmutations of metal from the palladium into other things. And it creates kind of a distribution of what types of metals are actually created in this process. And there's evidently that type of thing going on in that discovery.
Breaking it down a little further, too, in Fire from Ice, Eugene Maloff mentions, and so does Dr. Wood, is it's changing at the nuclear level. I guess the protons
right.
are changing. Maybe one is added or one is taken away, which might change something from copper to gold or iron,
right.
or something like that. Very different from the chemical, I guess, exchange, which a lot of people are saying, the critics often had mentioned about cold fusion that there was a chemical reaction and not a nuclear reaction. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Well, the reason why Pons and Fleischmann came forward and said that it had to be nuclear was, you know, chemical reactions do release amounts of energy depending on the type of reaction there was. And, you know, over time, chemists have been able to record the amounts of energy that are generated in reactions of various types, of all different types of elements with other elements, etc. And when they actually did their work with the palladium and the heavy hydrogen, they were getting factors of 10 more energy output than any chemical reaction that they were aware of. And that, I'm talking like maybe 4 to 5 times, or maybe even 10 to more times, actual energy output than any chemical reaction that they had ever. And I mean, these were leading chemists in their field. These weren't, you know, some guy that's mixing stuff in their garage. These guys had been well written. You know, they had written many, many, many papers. You know, they were at the top of their field. One was at Cambridge, the other one was at the University of Utah, and was fairly young. Mr. Pons, Stanley Pons, was actually only in the department for a few years, and he was already the department head of their chemistry department, and had studied under Martin Fleischmann over in England. So these folks were very well-respected chemists, and they knew their craft very well. They knew that nothing that they had ever experienced or had ever seen documented created the volume of energy that they were seeing.
Right. And there was measurable heat, I understand, as well, that they could point out. Interestingly, Russ, in the book, I'm very new to, I heard about cold fusion when it started. I remember hearing about it, but I also remember just on the periphery that it didn't work, and that's what the media was saying, it didn't work. However, reading this book, it was interesting to me that once the experiment was done and there was measurable output to theorize or say that this experiment did yield something beyond the break-even point, no one else, and not even Pons and Fleischmann, were able to reproduce that again. Is that accurate to say?
Well, no. Actually, Pons and Fleischmann had repeated it a number of times. The problem that they ran into was that the metal preparation for the palladium sometimes is inconsistent, and what they found was it was very difficult to repeat it because they didn't know exactly what it was about how that metal was prepared that specifically made sure that it would create the effect every time. Now, researchers since that time have gotten much better at it. They're still not perfect. I think some of them are up to about 70%. But a fallacy of science is that because you can't create it, recreate it every time, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And a good case in point is back when they were trying to clone animals. You know, they thought they could, and they kept trying. Well, finally, they got a positive result where they actually cloned an exact duplicate of an animal from cells from its body. It took them hundreds of times, and then, you know, after that, it took them hundreds more times before they could begin to replicate it consistently. And part of the difficulty with what was going on was they didn't know why specifically it worked, so it made it more difficult to recreate it. But the other thing that a lot of people found, and it's documented in Malow's book, mm-hmm. was that there were a lot of people that had a lot at stake in other forms of fusion research, like the hot fusion tokamaks and that sort of thing, and they had millions to billions of dollars riding on continuing to work on that research.
That's nuclear energy, essentially.
Right. That was what they called hot fusion. And what they would do is they would falsify their results. And Malov went back and started researching what MIT had done, because MIT had their own tokamak reactor, and they were pulling in millions of dollars a year for their research projects. And they had actually lowered their results so that it looked like they were not achieving overunity. And overunity is basically when you're actually producing more energy than what you're putting in.
Overunity, that's what it's called.
I think that's what they call it in the jargon of nuclear science, and when they're trying to actually achieve more energy output than what they're putting in.
When did you learn of cold fusion? You mentioned the 60 Minutes interview in a prior conversation. Was that when you heard about it?
No, I heard about it it was probably about 2006. The 60 Minutes interview was actually in 2009. In 2006, there was kind of a major split in the so-called truth movement. And those researchers who were supposedly and academics who were actually out there looking into the goings-on with the 9/11 fiasco at Ground Zero, it came to my attention that Stephen Jones had been involved in what had transpired back in 1989. So in starting to research some of that, I watched a video called Heavy Watergate that kind of talked about what happened with Pons and Fleischmann and who the players were. Well, the main one they noted was Stephen Jones. So I thought, well, I'll do some more looking up into this. And the Malov book was the best source, not so much for talking about the science of it as talking about what transpired.
It's a fantastic read, but I did start to read about Dr. Stephen Jones and his work and how he got grants from the Department of Energy to work on a version of cold fusion. It was called something else.
Well, and that's the thing. Cold fusion is really kind of a misnomer. He was working, you know, back in the mid-80s. He had actually worked on a piece of research that dealt with what they called muon-catalyzed fusion, where you actually had subatomic particles called muons. And again, I'm no expert on this, but that research never did, you know, come forward and go over unity. Yes, they did get some energy heat output that was beyond what was input, but it was never, you know, substantially much that it ever went anywhere. It was just, you know, good to know stuff. This is the kind of thing that can happen. But in the late 80s, he's changed what his research was, and part of it kind of centered on some research grants that Pons and Fleischmann had applied for through the DOE, meaning the Department of Energy. What he did was he was asked to review the research grant by a gentleman in the DOE. And here at the same time, he was actually doing similar experimentations. And it's not clear why he all of a sudden got into electrolysis, but it makes you wonder if, you know, seeing what they were doing made him get involved in that. And all of a sudden they were competing rather than one doing muon-catalyzed fusion and the others doing electrolytic analysis.
It's a very interesting thing, Russ, to clear. They meaning Fleischmann and Pons application, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And it starts you wondering, you know, and Malov couldn't be clear on it because he was so close to it in proximity to time. He was more just talking about what was known at the time, but it becomes kind of suspicious that all of a sudden Stephen Jones started doing electrolysis and electrolytic work versus doing the, you know, the more heavy physics laden muon catalyzed type fusion, where you're actually using more of the things that, that physicists use in trying to create fusion reactions.
I understand that, I think, which means you're more or less slamming atoms and things like that together.
Right, right. You're using particle accelerators and that sort of thing. And I mean, he did have access to that because he was actually working with the Los Alamos laboratories, and he was working with folks, I believe, out at Caltech. And that's an interesting connection there as well.
I don't understand it completely, but Stephen Jones and Pons and Fleischmann at the same time were doing press conferences and press releases and competing with each other on a really passive-aggressive level. But Stephen Jones was very critical of Fleischmann and Pons as well. What was going on there afterward? What do you suspect is happening?
During the time that all of this was occurring, Jones kind of made it sound like he was just trying to work with Fleischmann and Pons. But what happened was there was concern because both they were in different research universities. One was with BYU and Jones, and Pons and Fleischmann were representing the University of Utah. And, you know, they were looking at getting patents on the technology, and so Pons and Fleischmann, in fear that they might lose that for their university and all the research grant money that would come with that, they felt like they had to go public with it, even though they said 18 months at a minimum before the day in March that they actually went public. And at that point, that's when Jones became subversively adversarial and started forcing their hand. And, you know, down the road by, I think it was early May, he gave a presentation at the American Physical Society, which is basically all physicists, and he said, you know, who believes that these guys could possibly be right? Raise your hand. And unfortunately, that's not scientific at all. That's just a poll. Stirred up a lot of misinformation on what was going on. He did it with a very straight face, and that's what Malov described in the book, was that, you know, he kind of merged together how innocent and Boy Scoutish he appeared with some of the other actions that he actually took. And it was just amazing how, you know, it was just kind of subversive things that he would do. And then all of a sudden he'd kind of crack the whip, and he did that at the American Physical Society.
He was a Mormon, I understand, mm-hmm. A member of the Church of the Latter-day Saints in Utah. Again, we didn't mention this, but he was at Brigham Young University in Utah. Fast forward to 2006, 2009, I guess in that realm, he is involved in the 9/11 truth movement. We'll get to that point a little bit later. But other people, such as John Bockris at Texas A&M, reproduced on some level the Pons-Fleischmann cold fusion transmutation experiment. How accurate was that reproduction?
Well, there were people that still continued to say that their instrumentation must have been wrong, their recordings must have been incorrect. But as time went by, and, you know, all the way up into the 2000s, you know, there were a number of people, particularly chemists, I mean mostly chemists, who were doing the experimentation, and what they found was that it took them tremendous amounts of time, partly because they didn't know specifically why the preparation had to be as it was to get the reaction. But it would take them, you know, long periods of time. But what happened back in the 90s was the research as it existed at that point was tarnished so badly that no one could get any research funding for it. So the research, instead of surging forward with lots of money put toward it and lots of people working at it, it was basically shut down. No funding was given anywhere for it. If you did it, you had to do it on your own time, kind of in the closet, and hopefully not get caught, because if you were and you were at a research university, that meant you were, you know, diverting funds away from one thing to another.
A lot of the listeners of the station understand what we're talking about here, and that is the suppression of further investigating and experimenting with free energy possibilities.
Correct.
But you have pointed out now that this is unusually aggressively attacked. Eugene Malov points that out in his book, and in fact in his chapter 17, Hard Lessons in Science, he really goes through it. And he's got a number of segments in the chapter, resistance to paradigm shifts, dangerous analogies, the pathology of pathological science.
And you know, when he was writing this back in 1991, he really probably didn't have a sense of how much more of it was money-driven as opposed to just paradigm shifts. Most people struggle with paradigm shifts, you know, when it relates to religion, when it relates to major changes in understanding of things. Well, this was, to a degree, a major shift in understanding of things, but more so, it was the almighty dollar getting in the way. You know, the research folks in the major hot fusion research facilities is one thing, but when you get the level of negativity pushed by someone, at that point, nobody knew for sure what was going on. And to have that tremendous of an effort put toward squashing it.
Worldwide.
Worldwide. Leads you to believe that there had to be another motive behind it, because science will typically, you know, weed out falsehoods fairly easily. I mean, you can disprove things that don't exist. One of the neat parts of that CBS interview, it was with a Dr. Michael McCoubre, and he is listed as one of the folks that were researching in Malov's book. But he did indicate in that interview, he was able to repeat the science to it from the perspective of bad-mouthing the science. What 60 Minutes did, they actually brought in some physicists who had, you know, back in the 90s, had looked at the information and kind of discarded it as not being worth their time. Well, they brought a couple of these gentlemen back in, and they said, here, look at their data. Research their, understand their methods, look at their results. And the people in those interviews, they're like, looks pretty good to me, and it's something that they can repeat, and they've got it all documented. He said, the numbers don't lie. So, you know, science has a way of taking care of itself, and for somebody to just come in and say, you know, who believes something? Like Stephen Jones did before the American Physical Society back in 1989. That is totally against what science is about. Science is about going out and proving or disproving physical phenomena or whatever you're researching. And, you know, he wasn't doing that, and he was doing it very vociferously, and he was getting a lot of other folks on board doing that too.
Now, Russ, how does this level of conflict fast forward and connect with Dr. Judy Wood's work?
Okay. In the fall of 2005, there had been a number of various videos that had come out prior to the fall of 2005, and one of which kind of was brought to my attention and basically said there were a lot of physical issues with what happened with the Twin Towers. And one of them was the amount of time that it took for them to collapse. So I started paying attention to this. Well, suddenly this Dr. Stephen Jones was interviewed on the Tucker Carlson show. I think it was in like October of 2005, late fall or mid fall of 2005. And so then he started a group with James Fetzer of academics and industry folks who were engineers or physicists or whatever, who were researching 9/11. Over the course of the next few months, this group kind of congealed a large number of folks. Suddenly, it was like everybody was attacking Dr. Wood. And it's like, really? What's going on with that? Well, I really wasn't involved in all of the back and forth, but I did have a letter that I had written to a local newspaper person that was posted on their forum. And it just went crazy. And it was all attacking Dr. Wood's billiard ball example, which I cited in my letter. Because basically I said, you can get rid of all the politics of 9/11, but you can't get away from the science and the physics that went on with it. And suddenly everybody was just jumping all over Dr. Wood, bad-mouthing her, you know, nothing having to do with any of the science. Well, a few months forward down the road, it came to turn out that, you know, she was trying to do the research and she wasn't getting any of the materials that Dr. Jones said that he had that proved that there was thermite and other different things involved with the World Trade Center. And she said, we can't replicate anything because we can't see his data. We can't see any of the materials that he supposedly is testing and repeat them for verification purposes. So she finally just stepped back and away from all of that and started doing her own research, and it kind of, you know, flowered on its own that you can see in her book.
Was this 2005?
Her research really was in 2006 when she came forth with her first major paper. And it was labeled Star Wars beam weapon, but it wasn't Star Wars as in, you know, something from space was doing this. It was more related to SDI and the fact that there were various technology created as a result of SDI that possibly could have done what we saw based on the physical evidence in the pictures.
SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, is that
right?
Okay.
Right.
Once again, Stephen Jones pops up at a time where some sort of exotic energy or free energy is surfacing. The information is surfacing, and here he is once again to downplay this. And he's an interesting character. He's not alone. There are others, I suppose, that were involved, but Stephen Jones comes up again and again, and as Eugene Malov points out and you point out, there's a particular way about his personality that he somehow gets away with it.
Well, a lot of times what he'll do is he'll say, well, this couldn't possibly be, and kind of throw up his hands, and then he lets all the other folks that are around him, you know, kind of do the bad-mouthing and dirty work. He never actually does ever, you know, specifically bad-mouth anyone negatively, but he just puts it out there that, you know, they're just a problem, and then all the henchmen go out and really do the nasty work, and that's what we see all over the Internet related to the 9/11 work that Dr. Wood has done.
You had gone to a Stephen Jones presentation. Can you describe that briefly to listeners?
The presentation I went to was in June of 2006 in Chicago. This was kind of when the truther movement was getting all, you know, hot and heavy, and there was big events at Chicago and all around the country. And Dr. Jones spoke at that one. He was like a keynote speaker late on a Friday evening. I think it started Friday and then went all day and into Saturday night. He spoke late on Friday evening and basically gave an hour-long presentation, but most of his presentation really had nothing to do with the research on 9/11. It was all about corporate fascism and the destruction of our U.S. Constitution, religion, and how we need to be prepared for the end times, almost. It was a very religious-type discussion, and then right at the very end of his speech, he talked a little bit about, it was like he was giving us another little cracker to say, okay, we've got more information. And it talked a little bit about, you know, finding trace elements of thermite, small traces of this residue, supposedly. But yet, he didn't really talk about it at any great length. And it's like, you know, if you were talking about the science of what happened at Ground Zero, wouldn't you think you'd want to be talking about that the entire time?
One would think that would be the goal here, but I don't...
When you're a scientist.
If you're a scientist, and maybe some listeners aren't really sure about the thermite connection and how Dr. Judy Wood's investigative work looks at or responds to the thermite concept.
And I can talk about that a little bit. I mean, basically, these buildings were made out of steel and cement. And then around the outside of the building, the buildings were, to make them look silver and shine in the sunlight, there was aluminum cladding around the outside. So if you turn tons and tons and tons of steel and aluminum cladding into dust, what are you going to have in your residue? you're going to have aluminum and iron in your dust. When people are making the claims that, well, it's thermite residue, well, wow, is all of the dust thermite residue? Did any of it actually react? I mean, there's 6 and 8 inches deep dust all over the entirety of Manhattan after this happened, and it was pretty much probably all made of steel and aluminum because of the contents of what the buildings were made of.
And yes, and the dust is very unique, smaller than red blood cells. If it were thermite, thermite is used to destroy paperwork by the military. It's a weapon to destroy paperwork specifically. It flares up in brightness like a 4th of July sparkler, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. It gets white hot, gets to, you know, over 1,000 degrees, white hot. I mean, the light that it gives off. And these buildings didn't turn white hot. And for them to have completely disappeared, because when you look at the actual photographs of Ground Zero after the fact, there's just no debris left. I mean, less than a floor or two from the two towers, also gigantic holes in the basements, and the sub-basements underneath were not crushed in and full of debris. They were, by and large, intact or hollowed out with holes. It should have slumped to the ground. And the other thing with thermite is it takes a while to work. And when it starts cutting through things, you should have seen something sag here and sag there and something break. It wouldn't have all timed just perfectly all the way down, basically leave nothing left. And that was the thing that the thermite story really has a problem with.
It's just amazing, Dr. Wood's work here. Her KTEM lawsuit case against ARA within the NIST report, ARA, Applied Research Associates, contractor that was asked to prove how the towers fell for the NIST report, and the mock-up that ARA had designed to show that fire had melted steel and the towers came down. The ARA had signed off on that experiment, and Dr. Judy Wood says, no, you're defrauding taxpayers, and filed a lawsuit. The interesting thing is ARA is involved with manufacturing directed energy weapons. That's a very key thing here in these cover-ups, because you pointed out that a gentleman named Crockett Graby is also involved in researching space weapons and directed energy weapons, and he is also connected with Dr. Jones in the 9/11 cover-up. Can you describe what's going on there?
Well, Dr. Graby, back in the 1970s, actually was a research assistant or grad student assistant to a Mr. Steve Coonan, who was a physics professor out at Caltech. Mr. Coonan was actually involved with Stephen Jones in helping cover things up with the Pons and Fleischmann affair back in the 1980s. And he actually went before the American Physical Society at the same exact meeting that Dr. Jones was and said there is no way that this could happen. He had a chemist from Caltech. His name was Nathan Lewis, and they're both pictured in Dr. Malov's book, that there is no way that what Pons and Fleischmann had discovered could possibly be. Now, Dr. Graby taught a class with Dr. Coonan. He later became a visiting professor at the University of Iowa, and actually in 1991, about the same time that Dr. Malov was writing his book, he was writing a book called Space Weapons and the Strategic Defense Initiative. And he devotes an entire appendix, which is about 35 to 40 pages, of his book talking about directed energy weapons. Not specifically how the physics works, but he understood that they existed and that they could be used for different things. And so he was trying to prove a point in his book that they couldn't necessarily be used for various defense initiatives as SDI was set up. But he also acknowledged that they existed, which would seem to tell you that he knows all about how they work. Now flash forward to 2005 and beyond, and all of a sudden he's working right alongside Stephen Jones, and a lot of his focus and a lot of the focus of Jones's group is going after Dr. Wood's work rather than doing scientific analysis of the buildings.
Same thing with the cold fusion issue.
Exactly.
It's the same MO.
The thing is, Crockett Grabe knows about directed energy weaponry. He knows that it exists. And then for somebody like Dr. Wood to come forward and say, after you eliminate everything else, because basically that's what she did with her research. She didn't go out and say, I think it's directed energy, and then go out and try to frame everything to look like that. What she did was she said, okay, here's everything that we know physically. How does it measure up with what we see in the photographs? And over a course of time, she was able to eliminate those things that could not possibly have occurred, and one of which, you know, was the whole thermite thing. And every time she would disprove thermite, the type of thermite used would change. And so she'd keep disproving all of them for one reason or another. But when she basically got finished with what she was doing, all that was left was directed energy as a possibility.
It shows you that the researchers, independent researchers, are coming up against a wall, and strategic players who attack, and, well, they don't use science in their attacks, and it's nothing there. It's ad hominem attacks usually on the research. But let's now go into the appearance of an interconnectivity between cold fusion and directed energy technology at Ground Zero. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Well, the cold fusion technology, the types of residues that were being found, you know, there was a small tritium tracing, but it's the larger idea that there's energy output that is far and above what we would expect from any kind of chemical. Say there were bombs that had busted up the building, there had been thermite that was possibly used, you know, that's been roundly disproven by the research, but we have far more energy usage, or at least what appears to be more energy created to actually bring these buildings apart. I mean, they basically turned them into powder at the molecular level. Well, the amount of energy that it would take for something mechanically to do that would just be massive. So you have this interplay of technology that can create enormous amounts of output energy without input. There would appear to be different connections based on the elemental changes, and I think Dr. Wood notes that in her book that some of the elements that are found and actually documented by Stephen Jones, save for a couple of different elements, you know, are very consistent with what was seen in the research by some of the other cold fusion folks, one of which is this Tadahiko Mizuno out of Japan. He actually put some charts in his book called Nuclear Transmutation. He actually put charts in his book showing these are unusual results where you have certain elemental levels that suddenly are created when you do this work. And to some degree, that was showing up in the elements that were being found in some of the dust samples that were taken at Ground Zero. So there is that connection related to that, but it's the overall free energy type of research that appears very, very consistent between the two.
Right. Well, the research into directed free energy, a lot of that material is classified, of course, weaponized, unfortunately. There's a lot at stake for those controlling the energy resources human beings use on this planet. But what are Pons and Fleischmann doing now?
Well, they're kind of living in retirement, kind of forced retirement. They were so roundly attacked for what they had come out with that within a few years they were actually kind of forced out of their positions. They were mocked publicly to the point where they couldn't present their research because they would immediately be attacked for anything related to cold fusion. So I think Dr. Pons is now in France, kind of in seclusion. And Martin Fleischman has, you know, he's been out of research. He's in his 80s now. You know, he was in his 60s at the time, and he was just kind of forced out of the type of research that he felt he could make a difference with, and that's why he felt it was so important.
Russ, let's look at the darker side of what's going on here, because there have been suspicious murders. And we'll start with Dr. Eugene Malov, author of Fire from Ice, a very important book that describes in detail the cold fusion story and the players involved. How was he murdered? What happened there?
Well, he was actually, I believe, at his childhood home. His parents, I believe, had passed away. And he was at his childhood home where they had lived, and he was doing some cleaning up around the property. I don't know if they were getting ready to sell the place or whether he was just maintaining it or just what. But he was shot, I believe, in the back of the head, and it was almost execution style, you know, the type of murder that it was. I believe they did catch some people that they supposedly had murdered him. But again, it was a very shady thing, and the heck of it was in 2004. And this was just before the whole 9/11 truth thing came out, and of course, you know, Dr. Stephen Jones's coming out party. And, you know, over the 13 or 14 years since Fire from Ice had been created, Dr. Malov was able to learn a lot more about the behavior of Stephen Jones and how he had basically trashed what Pons and Fleischman had done. So, you know, had he come out as the face of 9/11 truth and then started doing the same things that he did back in 1989, Malov would have been the first one to raise his hand and say, something doesn't smell right here.
And he would have been credible.
Oh, he'd have been very credible. I mean, he would have recognized exactly what was going on. So, yeah, his murder is very suspicious from that very perspective.
Russ, you formulated a very interesting timeline that revealed that wasn't the only murder involved here with people, brilliant minds researching this area of free energy. Can you describe a little bit about how you formulated that timeline and then that other murder?
Well, another murder of an individual was to a Michael Zeber, and his name is spelled, I think it's Z-E-B-U-H-R. What's interesting about that is, one, he was a graduate student of Dr. Judy Wood. She had kind of shown him the research that she had done to this point related to 9/11 and Ground Zero. That was about the time that Jones and actually Dr. Wood were kind of butting heads over being able to share the evidence and share the research. He suddenly was killed. He was on spring break up in Minneapolis, St. Paul. A couple of young African-American gentlemen shot him execution style, just like Eugene Malov. Well, the connection to Eugene Malov gets even better, because Michael Zeber had an uncle, William Zeber, who was actually like the assistant editor or second in command of a magazine called Infinite Energy that Eugene Malov was putting together. And they had been putting it together for many years after the whole cold fusion thing. And it actually tracked that research by those people who were still doing it. So that now all of a sudden you have the connection of Michael Zeber with Eugene Malov right there.
To some people, this is seen to send a message. To those interested in researching this area of free energy, or even the title of the magazine, Infinite Energy, you put together that timeline. Can you describe that timeline a little bit? I think it's interesting for listeners to get a understanding of the series of events.
Well, basically the timeline gets back into who the players were back in 1989, the relation between Steve Coonan and Caltech, Crockett Grabe and Caltech, related to the cold fusion fiasco, and then comes forward and says, okay, here's all the different things that transpired with the 9/11 cover-up and who the players were and, you know, what happened to them over the course of time. Now, one of the other events that actually occurred, when Dr. Wood was putting together, first she put together a request for correction with NIST so that she could be on record as having actually pointed out the problems with their reporting and the frauds that existed with what was reported upon. After she did the request for correction and it was denied, she then filed a federal QI-TAM whistleblower case in which she basically said that the folks that were the subcontractors for NIST, who were engineering firms, you know, the ARAs, the SAICs, Scientific Applications International Corp, these people should have known what they were seeing when they saw it. And obviously they didn't do the things that they were commissioned to do because they never did prove how the buildings came apart. They just quit when they said collapse was initiated and it was inevitable that the buildings would come apart, and they quit. So they didn't really de-engineer anything related to that. Well, when Dr. Wood actually was in the process of filing the QI-TAM case, all of a sudden we had this major shooting at Virginia Tech. Now, for those people that don't know, Dr. Wood did all of her undergrad and postgraduate work at Virginia Tech. What's interesting is that where these events occurred were precisely in the dorm as well as the actual building that she attended and actually lived in. Now, there were actual professors and students in the mechanical engineering department where she actually did all of her studies that were killed in all of this. And there were also people killed in the dorm where she stayed on the exact same floor that she actually lived on. So in retrospect, you say, well, it's coincidental, but it's like, how coincidental can it be? As I was following all of these different things that are on this timeline, I got to thinking about Crockett Grabe, because he had come out as a supporter of Dr. Jones and had written numerous articles for him and actually had written one against Dr. Wood. What he basically had been involved with back at the University of Iowa, I got to thinking about. There was a similar situation that occurred at the University of Iowa in the fall of 1991. And this was exactly 3 months to the day after his book had come out on space weapons. There was a supposed doctoral student in the physics department, which is the specific department that he was in, that went in and started shooting on a shooting rampage just exactly like Virginia Tech. And, you know, at the time that Virginia Tech occurred, it got me to thinking about what had happened at the University of Iowa, because it was exact modus operandi. You had the same, it was an Oriental, I think he was Chinese, they were both Chinese graduate students who went on a shooting rampage and supposedly killed a bunch of people. When I went back at the University of Iowa, and I thought, well, does Dr. Grabe have any connection to it? Was he a witness to it? Has he ever written on it? And as it turns out, he wrote an article 7 years after the fact for the Des Moines Register talking specifically about being right there and knowing the players that were killed in that whole situation. And he related how his father was, you know, a good friend of the, I don't know, he was like the head of the physics department that was shot and killed that day. He talked very graphically about having been a witness to this whole thing. So it's like, no, it doesn't prove that he had any specific involvement, but it sure is unusual that he could be right in the middle of something like that that is so similar to what was connected to Dr. Wood, that was maybe trying to send a message to her that she better be quiet and not continue on with what she's doing.
Russ, thank you for going through that incredible work that you've done, and I really, really appreciate that. And I noticed that Dr. Wood, as far as I know, doesn't talk about any of this in public.
No. The reason she does not is because she doesn't want to take away from her own scientific analysis of Ground Zero. She feels that stands on its own merit, and she does not need to, you know, drag this other information into it. But it's all out there, and I'm not saying that any specific person is involved in anything like that. I'm just saying the coincidences are starting to stack up to a degree where you cannot possibly imagine that they are just coincidences. It's just hard to imagine that all of these things can play out the way they did. Now, a couple other things that Dr. Gravey did, you know, within a few weeks of 9/11 happening, he wrote a specific article that said this was something just waiting to happen. Your listeners are probably familiar, back in August of 2007.
What was waiting to happen?
That, you know, there was going to be an event at Ground Zero,
okay,
but that it wasn't what we thought, okay? And that these buildings were, you know, they were destroyed, but they weren't destroyed by terrorists, but it was an event waiting to happen somehow. So then you fast forward to 2007, and the I-35 bridge in Minneapolis-St. Paul, within about a week of that event occurring, he wrote an article for the Cedar Rapids Gazette saying, you know, this bridge was going to come apart. It was an event waiting to happen again. And he said that by driving over it with his car, with springs and shock absorbers and everything else, he could feel that that bridge was going to come apart. It was a broken down bridge that needed to be fixed. Well, here's the problem with that whole premise. When you look at the video of the actual bridge, when it starts to come apart, every support, and there are like, I don't know, six on each end of the piece that went down, they all gave way at the exact same time. It wasn't like you had a weak link somewhere. It broke, the bridge started to collapse one direction, and then the other supports couldn't hold it. It didn't drop like that. Everything collapsed at the same time, and the actual deck of the bridge went straight down flat. The cars that were on it didn't even fall off.
A lot of people didn't think that was a natural event. I wanted to ask you if you had any book suggestions for listeners, if they're interested in finding out more on this thread of free energy, cold fusion.
Well, I would say, one, if the Fire from Ice book from Dr. Malov is the gold standard, because it really talks about who the players were that were involved, and it talks about how they behaved and how unnaturally they behaved as people of science. And, you know, if you're still skeptical on the connections that are loosely being made here about the other players, you have to look at it and say, would scientists really waste their time continuing to beat down something? If you went out and proved it scientifically, then you don't waste any more time with. But yet, the amount of effort that went into continuing to beat down this research, and then you fast forward and say, okay, same players are involved with Dr. Wood's work related to Ground Zero, and they're doing the same thing.
All involving free energy.
Right. And if you did an assessment of the number of articles that were written by the Stephen Jones Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice Group, if you actually go out and figure out how many articles they've written, a large percentage of their articles are pointed at Dr. Judy Wood. And it's like, you know, if her research can be debunked through scientific analysis, why would you waste your time continuing? You know, you wouldn't waste your time. You'd work on the research that proves what you're trying to prove, and that is that there was problems at Ground Zero. But they're not doing that. They're spending more time focused on her than they are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And none of their research that comes out is credible.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.